Welcome, or welcome back. Boy, it's sure good to open an episode with that greeting. And if you got the invite or followed a somewhat familiar link to this podcast, I hope that you're glad to be hearing a familiar voice as well. Yes, it's me, septuagenarian curmudgeon Marty Young, living in Georgia, but with a large part of my heart still on the northeast side of Indianapolis, Indiana, Primrose Avenue, to be exact, in the 1950s and 60s. I'm, again, your travel guide, curator, and sometimes docent of a treasure trove of memories, but one who has been on a hiatus since last fall. It's been 5 months since my golden-throated tones have graced the airwaves of the World Wide Web at the address connected with the podcast called The Primrose Chronicles. So for whatever reason you dropped in today, I'm glad you've landed here. To the handful coming around who have been wondering, where have you been? This installment is going to answer that burning question. To the greater number, who might note this announcement and think, oh yeah, I haven't seen anything new from the old guy for a while, or I didn't even notice he was gone, or still worse, at least to my fragile ego, what in the heck is this post about a new Primrose Chronicles effort, and why did it cross my inbox or Facebook page, and what button do I hit to block further notifications? I can only plead that now that you've clicked the link and found this recent audio installment, that you'll listen long enough to be a part of my audience count as I trudge toward 10,000 downloads. Yep, you're right. I'm ever the mercenary. But the first order of business, for those who have awaited this return, let me deal with the rumors that have surrounded my break from broadcasting. Unequivocally, I must state that the news of my demise has been grossly exaggerated. Also, I must note that no part of this is in any way an AI endeavor. Neither of any merit are rumors of my run-in with the gaggle of lawyers representing persons claiming to be the real-life inspiration for characters in stories from the first two seasons causing me to close down operations. In truth, injunctions from my defense team will postpone any actions to well into 2025. Actually, the majority of characters identifiable to those connected to the activities and times surrounding the old neighborhood in seasons 1 and 2 have granted unretractable permission for me to speak of their exploits. Either that or they're dead, so that has not been much of an issue. Some even suggested, though, that I had perhaps gone off on my own odyssey in aspirations of collecting new tales. Oh, would that this time away had been filled with exploits and adventures that might bring me alongside other literary travelers like Tolkien's Bilbo and Frodo, Jules Verne's Captain Nemo and Phineas Fogg, or this project being more of a first-person narrative. Perhaps I was retracing the route of Steinbeck across America with his poodle Charlie. It could be. Some might have mused that this old contrarian had waxed more philosophical and taken a road less traveled, or even escaped to a hermitage to ponder the road not taken, or set up camp alongside a secluded Walden pond to transcendentally escape. To all those considerations as to my online whereabouts, I must say, you give me too much credit. Just as I may give some of my listening audience too much credit for even understanding the literary references that I piled into those last few sentences. No, after nearly 5 dozen tales and interviews since March 21st, 2022, hey, I've got an anniversary coming up. Anyway, since March 21st, 2022, this podcast project came to a screeching halt last fall as I was notified of the need for major heart surgery, and the sooner the better. To say the least, a recording hobby would be the least of my activities as plans around TPC quickly went on the back burner. I briefly, and looking back rather nonchalantly, mentioned bringing the curtain down on season 2 early and delaying the launch on your host's 3rd season effort. I apologize if I did not give any specific updates at the time. Hopefully today will rectify a lot of that. So allow me to use these next few minutes to finally bring you up to speed so that the next program that drops after this one will return us all to that time when life was a holiday on Primrose Lane, or Avenue. In the process of this chapter, though, things will be very different. If you are in any way a frequent surveyor of the stories told during these half-hour vignettes, you know, for the most part, either through my telling or occasionally my conversation with others who were impacted by or themselves impacted those golden decades, I've tried to garner a longing to return nostalgically to that simpler time for my listeners, even if one had never lived it himself. The central event in my experience of these last 5 months, however, have actually caused me, for a time at least, to appreciate elements of this current time in which we presently live. It may make for a cockeyed view, keeping one eye on the past while recounting current events, but I hope you'll listen in on my reflections. I'm confident it will be good therapy for me at least, so here we go. A routine physical checkup in the course of finding a new healthcare provider, brought about by our move from Utah to Georgia, led to a physician's expression of concern that I had been on a blood thinner medication for over 20 years without any change of dosage or prescription. He referred me to a cardiologist, who in turn ordered an echocardiogram, which prompted a heart catheterization, which ultimately revealed blockages ranging from 75 to 100% in four arteries around my heart. After expressing mild surprise as to why I was maintaining as commonplace a quality of life as I seemed to be displaying, my third medical professional in 3 weeks, this time a cardiothoracic surgeon, indicated my options were to do nothing and get progressively worse, or have four CABGs done. My call. But he suggested soberly, the sooner the better. Now, the only cabbage I was aware of was the foul-smelling cooked cousin of lettuce, whose aroma nearly set me retching whenever it wafted through the screen door of a customer's home as I waited to collect their weekly remittance for newspapers I delivered on my route, as employed as a pre-adolescent paperboy for the Indianapolis Star-News. Some of my customers seemed oblivious to its rank odor, having it for supper weekly and usually the night I collected. This meant when I came by around supper time for their weekly payment, I could be certain from the time I parked my bike in the driveway, conducted my transaction at the door, and finally rode down the street to the next home that I would have to breathe through my mouth to not invoke a serious gag reflex. But I digress. Dr. Molina, as my surgeon was known professionally, was not directing me to a diet of coleslaw or sauerkraut, however. He was scheduling me for the surgical prep and subsequent procedure for four coronary artery blockage grafts, C-A-B-G, CABG. And it became an acronym with which I would become most familiar going forward. Allow me to use that same abbreviation going forward with you all as well. As he and his various team members explained it, I became aware that this was a big deal. I wanted to know from a reliable source, in addition to Sean Murphy on The Good Doctor, what I was in for. And what I discovered was one of the reasons I'm growing in my appreciation of living in the time that I do, even while considering the blissful elements of the life and times and culture I have come to write and talk about so much over the years. In this 21st century world, my thirst for information would not have to take me to a card file in a local library, requiring knowledge of the Dewey Decimal System for guidance into books and periodicals that then may or may not have been checked in. As much as the volumes of the neighborhood repository of tomes held my rightful allure for me growing up, it still fascinates me today that my pocket, or more often my hand, holds not only a telephone and its accompanying directory of contacts, but also a personal telegraph, a photo album, notepad, road atlas, and yes, encyclopedia, to mention just a few of its functions. and to the end of my discoveries through that mobile device, I now can get all the skinny on heart bypass surgery and an understanding of the whole CABG procedure. Insufficient detail to even observe an actual surgery on my own private viewing screen if I so desired. Now, as much as I have FOMO, which is a fear of missing out, I realize I had no desire, really, to watch a surgery documentary that exposed me to the stripping of veins from the legs and laying them alongside as a human chest was cracked open and the cavity was spread wide. I just really couldn't handle that visual stimulus. I did not want to witness arteries to all different parts of my body, north and south, being redirected from their natural routes internally to a machine on a nearby table that would handle the life-giving blood flow while the real heart went offline to allow skilled specialists to attach aforementioned veins on either side of each blockage, creating a new path for blood flow and establishing greater ease of cardiac pumping with lessened pressure. Once all the obstructions were bypassed, I could see natural bloodlines were disengaged from the machine, reconnected to the organ for which God made them. And that was all amazing, but I just didn't need the particulars so up close and personal. As fascinating and informative as that video might have been, I preferred scrolling down in my pocket library to find out first the history of CABG procedures. It was then that I learned that when I was just a lad of six in 1954, the first bypass was done in Indianapolis. Successfully, I might add, to the great acknowledgement and celebration, as was the case across the nation and the civilized world, as medical teams pioneered and then improved upon this life-giving operation. Well, then my question was, how risky was it for me today, a man of my years and physical condition? And it was then that I was exposed to another fact that made me appreciate living with 21st century medicine. According to my electronic mini medical journal, between 250,000 and 500,000 CABGs are done annually in the U.S., making it either the second or third most common surgery, right behind knee replacements at 750,000 and maybe hip replacements at 450,000, the majority of which was done on people 55 years and older. Well, to my way of thinking, this was like a rite of passage for us baby boomers. And since I'd already had both the other replacements, I might as well go for the trifecta. Let's do it. Well, surgery was scheduled at one of Atlanta's premier heart institutes, then rescheduled, and then rescheduled again before being delayed on that last day from 5:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. each time because, in their explanation, the heart specialist was called to a more serious heart surgery. More serious? Had they not watched the video? Then, with more reflection, it only validated the suggestion of the articles that it was risky, yes, but really no big deal. So on Tuesday, October 11th, Diane, that's my wife, and I arrived at the hospital. We gathered in a cardiac waiting room in anticipation of my being prepped for the average, run-of-the-mill CABG. Well, someone forgot to tell my daughter, who came in all the way from California, and my brother and his wife, who came down from Indiana, that it was no big deal. So they joined the vigil for my recovery. Also, to my great appreciation and comfort, prayer teams from throughout the Atlanta area, across the nation, and mission partners across the world lifted petitions in my behalf. And all that was in place as I went into pre-op and subsequently was wheeled down sterile white hallways into a frigid alabaster operating room where white-robed and masked attendants stood at the ready to preside over everything portrayed on my handheld screen if I'd chosen to watch it. But now I was the featured attraction, and I was going to miss it, or at least viewing it. Little to report after reciting the first four or five numbers counting down from 100, 99, I was under anesthesia. And I'm told that I was oblivious to any activity, and it's probably a good thing. And more appreciatively, I was oblivious to the pain until I was wheeled to my intensive care room designated for cardiac patients about 6 hours later. And at that moment, I had some 19 tubes projecting from that many parts of my body, some pumping, some dripping, some allowing flow away, others flowing toward and in. There were drains and picks, and slowly I was becoming aware of their functions and the pain that their cumulative presence, as well as the stitches and the wiring, internal and external, were providing. Thanks to the varying levels of medication, though, given orally and intravenously in generally timely doses, I settled in for recovery and was, for the most part, a model patient. Just ask any nurse, except Steve. He got from me as good as he gave. And over the next several days, the tubes and the drains and the catheters were removed one by one, all the while nurses trying to get me to my feet, out of bed, into a chair, to a commode, into the bathroom, down the hall, all in preparation to be discharged and go home. Now, I could share particulars of all that are standard in most hospital stays, regardless of length. I was in for 14 days. Those standard recollections were that the food was terrible, thus a 14-day fast. Sleep was a premium because of the taking of vitals and the administering of medicine that was to make you drowsy every 2 hours, 24/7. And if you really wanted to know something, you asked the nurses. Two occurrences, though, that were unusual for me anyway, also brought recollections of childhood experiences and thus warrant my sharing here before this yarn concludes to keep it in some way a testimony to the Primrose Chronicles saga. So let me take you back before I bring you back forward. As most of you know, the Young Clan, of which I'm the oldest sibling, lived on Primrose Avenue in the first block, that would be the 4400 block, from which the street headed north before dead-ending into Broad Ripple Park. More germane to this telling is that the Indiana State Fairgrounds, with its enclosed coliseum, sat two blocks to our south. Several events were held in that arena multiple times a year, and one of them was the Ringling Brothers Barnum & Bailey Circus. Now, we didn't always take in the circus as an annual event, but most years, Dad took us in the station wagon down to the Monon train station, 38th and Winthrop, adjacent to the fairgrounds, the day prior to the circus opening, to watch the train bring in the equipment, the apparatus, and the animals. That was lions and tigers and bears and monkeys and dogs and horses, as I remember. But lastly, always, off came the elephants, pulling heavier equipment, lumbering toward the fairgrounds gate, down the midway thoroughfare to their stalls adjacent to the Coliseum floor. Now, there was no charge to watch the unloading, and so we did this frequently. And I share this because I distinctively remember one unusual procedure that involved all the pachyderms one year, and now that I was in that ICU, I recalled it in detail. So back to Indy, though, there was this one year that the train arrived and most of the elephants disembarked, but instead of heading straight for their quarters, their handlers gathered them around an apparatus, hard to describe, but it was made up of heavy wood logs and steel rigging and canvas straps, and they harnessed them together to walk in a circle. And as they walked in the circle, they would wind the strap that they shared around a stake at the spot of their walking path. Now, before they began to do that, though, on the opposite side of the apparatus was a baby elephant that seemed to be in some kind of health distress. It just barely had made it down the ramp when its knees had buckled. And just before it collapsed, circus hands quickly ran with three additional canvas straps and ran those under the youngster to a hoist above it. There were two under its body and one around its neck or head area. And now, on the other end, the three or four adult elephants were led, again, around that stake, each rotation turning the straps around the tent peg, and the result was lifting the baby off its feet to a level on the opposite side where a small cart could be wheeled underneath it. At which point the mammoth team reversed their directions at their handler's command, allowing the sick little Tusker to just be placed on a wagon, unstrapped, and hauled to the circus veterinarian who was standing by for diagnosis and treatment, and I hope subsequent recovery. It was really amazing. Now, I only saw that in one day, but it was memorable. And that being said, I hadn't really considered that vision for many years. That is, until the ICU room where I lay. Now, let me just say, having your sternum cracked open, ribs flayed wide, heart cut and sutured, and a variety of other activities that were necessary but beyond normal function leaves you one weak puppy. Believe me. Early on, I could not move up or down on my bed, nor roll over, nor sit up, much less depend on my legs for mobility. The kindness of strangers, the nurses, were my only help to accomplish the most basic of functions. 6'8", 350 pounds, inert body, had to assume positions using only the efforts of petite caregivers and a couple of male attendants. How in the world were they going to do it? Well, in short, they would replicate the principle of the circus endeavors. In my situation, three sets of canvas straps of three different lengths, red and green and yellow, I believe, were likewise involved. They were already under me, lying across the bed when I was first taken to it. But then I noticed that there was also an apparatus that hung above me and moved on a track in the ceiling. A remote control operated a carabiner that could be lowered to reach the two ends of each colored strap and then be attached accordingly, based on the needed placement and elevation. I came to realize that my mammoth frame could be lifted from the bed, sometimes to allow for changing of bedding, or be swung down the track and around to a spot where I hovered over a hospital bed. And hitting the down switch, I was lowered into a place where I could receive visitors. Another flip of the controls, and in a more private moment, I could also be positioned on the bedside commode. Hey, I'm trying to put it delicately, okay? After an appropriate time receiving visitors or taking care of business, I could be returned to a freshly made-up bed in reverse fashion. Yes, it was humbling. Certainly, it was time-consuming. Admittedly, I would have preferred to have done it on my own. But in those early moments when recovery was slow and tedious, I lapsed into periods of recollection of the circus and the elephants and the little Dumbo, and realized that for brief periods each day, I was he, and he was me. Well, it looks like I've still got a little time, so let me share one more experience that offered a childhood memory component as well. You see, as a youngster, I did not keep the cleanest of bedrooms for 6 days a week. Diane would say I didn't keep a clean house until she moved in. But at any rate, as a child, trash was relegated to the floor. It was certain to reach that spot where it could be retrieved and discarded on Saturday morning before cartoons, so why give multiple efforts daily? Additionally, school clothes, play clothes, sports uniforms, and sleepwear were also most frequently left in piles of assorted sizes. Sometimes there was reasoning to the mound's contents, but for the most part, it was just whatever was closest when the undressing occurred, that's where the pile formed. And since I shared an upstairs attic room with my little brother, Dave, who looked up to me as a model in so many things, so that together we doubled the clothing volume, until on that Saturday it was taken to the basement and sorted in front of the washer by color, white, slacks, shirts. But again, it was only once a week. And until that magical weekend morning, stacks of apparel and physical evidence of two boys' lives littered the floor. Now, the reason I admit this foible so readily is to describe what happened when the sun went down on Primrose. The street lights came on. The two tired heirs to the young family fortune settled down to what would eventually result in sleep. But sometimes, in the dark 30 hours that followed, The stacks and mounds seem to transform even to the point of the appearance of living creatures by youngsters in their beds startled awake by a summer thunderstorm or a neighborhood dog barking too closely. Many a night, fear of the slightly formed created in the fertile mind images of invaders or monsters or animated minions seemed just waiting for us to slumber, lying on the floor of our room. And in addition, dresser drawers left open and hanging pictures, cockeyed, took on a different appearance when the shadows of night fell over them. But it had been a long time since my sleeping arrangements had given me a background for strange dreams and apparitions. That, too, changed one night in ICU post-op when, after the night shift personnel dimmed the lights before returning to their lounge break tables, hallucinations that rivaled and even exceeded imagined creatures of a primrose bedroom took over my thoughts. For one long night, a series of coherent images, memorable even as I share them with you, still stir an unsettled sense of things not quite right, rendering me in the moment unable to escape or rectify. So let me tell you about it. Unlike my shared bedroom in Naptown, my ICU private room had a place for everything and everything in its place. It should. I counted at least 28 different nurses and attendants who passed through my hopefully temporary residence, recording vitals, bringing and removing usually untouched food trays. And each time they passed through, surfaces were wiped down, charts were updated and filed at the room desk, and glove supplies were replenished for those who would be making the further rounds. Well, I was supposed to be down for the night. I'd been given sleeping pills and an additional sedative through my IV, and doze I did, for a while. But this one time, for a reason still unknown to me, I awoke from what must have been a fitful slumber, confused and unsure of where I was. I had tossed and turned as much as anyone with over a dozen tubes protruding up and down my body could, resulting in my bed sheets wrapping around me in several different directions, if that was possible. I had a fresh understanding of the biblical term swaddling clothes. I was being swaddled, and it terrified me because of the constriction. Even worse, somewhere in the wrappings was my call button, my contact with the outside world, and I could not locate it, and I could not reach anyone to report my dilemma. I tried to yell, but all that the surgery had done to both my coronary and pulmonary systems left me with a pathetic, breathless whimper of a sound, and no one responded. But it was then that I realized I was not actually alone in my room. Earlier, I had observed and conversed with nurses about two small machines on wheels with control panels set on white triangular surfaces. Extending from the panel on each side were two blue hoses, maybe 3 inches in diameter, with nozzles on the end. Inquiring minds wanted to know their purpose, and I was told that they were bear hugger forced air warming units used to keep patients warm under their blankets in the frozen tundra that I had already come to observe was the ICU. Curiosity quenched, I hadn't thought any more about it. But having been awakened so unceremoniously, those machines seemed to take on life forms. Now, as I was known to do, I had earlier teased those tasked with caring for me, and in my mind, I thought it was their time for payback. Before my very eyes, you see, both of the control panels of each warmer had morphed into two little girls in white mime makeup, and with the hoses now arms above their heads, they stared. They just stared. But looking at every moment like they would speak and maybe cross the room and approach my bed. Now, at first I tried to have a staring contest with them, but they didn't blink, they didn't speak, they didn't attempt to reach me, they just leered. And over time, I finally surrendered and I yelled to the nurses that they had gotten even. All right, I'm sorry. Come get those clown-faced lasses. But I still had no call button. And I could not muster up a loud enough shout to be rescued. Then I realized those two under the desk were the least of my companions. Two vertically hanging paintings, maybe a foot wide and 4 feet long, depicting green vines and fern leaves were changing before my eyes as well. And out of the scenery appeared an angel first, that in turn transformed into an old man as the hands of the clock inset, which formed their faces, moved around the numbers. And their expressions changed as time marched on in my ICU magical mystery tour. And as the old man became more defined, coming up from beneath him was an old woman, and finally beneath her an elephant, perhaps from the earlier circus recollection, all making an effort to leave the picture frame and also advance on my bed. Now, I know your response is likely at this point, Marty, you're a sick man. You need help, and you have my pity. But wait, there's more. My bed faced a wall on which a big screen TV hung. It was between the animated paintings, and it was on, really more for white noise and soft lighting, but now it was becoming the portal through which Donald and Melania Trump were entering my room without invitation, without word of salutation or greeting, and as near as I can recall, they proceeded then to, at the end of my bed, let me in on all the campaign strategy of the next year that would gain for him the presidency. And lest I forget, they visited me, I think, 3 times that night. Now, I felt like it had been quite a few hours. I know I was dripping with perspiration. My breathing was heavy. And just in time, the 4 a.m. charge nurse showed up on the scene, patiently hearing my description of what had been to me a series of harrowing events as she took readings, dispensed pills, and asked about my pain level. Finally, she simply observed, "Perhaps we need to adjust your meds." Do you think? It was indeed the last time that the Mime Girls, the old couple, or the Trumps joined me in my hospital surroundings. But now, over 4 months later, I'm still alone with my thoughts about that night. There are not enough unusual happenings beyond that night to extend this episode, so I'm going to wrap it up. I returned home the end of October using a walker and having home therapy exercises. I have physically continued to improve, but I admit to you, my loyal fans, that I have not had the desire or the creativity to launch the promised third season of TPC until recently. Articles found while scrolling in my handheld catalog of information suggest that this also is a part of the post-op process. So the fact that this is available for download must mean that my emotional recovery is also progressing. Now, whether this story resonates with you who are familiar with the Chronicles, dealing with the simpler, happier, distant times, I cannot determine without your personal feedback, so please let me know. I only know that I needed to get this story out before I could turn my thoughts to the purposes for which I began to talk about Primrose 3 years ago. As a result, though, I think in a sense the logjam is broken. I have future episodes ready to share that will bring us together at the Saturday afternoon kitty matinee and the escapades there. We'll be in the industrial arts shop for a time. I'll be also sharing my soul about the time that I was spurned on the eve of a high school dance. And depending on what I hear from you about this bridge effort, 21st century may also be examined under the microscope again of the 50s and 60s. In addition, several new interviews are also being scheduled with details soon to follow. Again, if you have ideas or topics that might be developed or guests that might be entertaining, drop me a note at theprimrosechronicles@gmail.com or personal message me at the Primrose Chronicles Facebook page. Lastly, let me simply say thank you for drifting back into this orbit after I myself have been drifting in an attempt to return to this mic. I think I'm doing well, ready to once again assume a position on my primrose porch stoop and see what passes by in the thoroughfare of thoughts. And thank you for coming alongside and checking things out from my perspective as well. So, thanks for your thoughts, thanks for your prayers, and oh yeah, blessings from Primrose Lane, Avenue.